right, if y'all are ready, clerk will call the next case.
Report when I call, Dontrell Longstaff versus the State Detective. Nancy Support, Mr. Billy Jackson, will argue for the appellant, and Mr. John Stevens will argue for the state.
Thank you very much. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. As the clerk stated, I represent Mr. Dock, and what I really want to focus on today in the argument is two particular issues related to his confession. The first one is what we raise in ground number one, which is a way that the police were circumventing the Miranda rules. And to put a little context into that, in Missouri versus Seibert, which I believe is a Supreme Court case, and I think it came out about 8 years ago or so. And in that case, the Supreme Court was addressing a procedure that had been developed by some police agencies where what they were doing was getting defendants in for interrogations, not giving them their Miranda rights, getting them then to give a confession, and then giving them their Miranda rights, and then leading them to restate the confession that they had given without getting their Miranda rights. And the Supreme Court ruled that that was invalid and that that could not be done, and because it was a circumvention of Miranda. And, of course, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals followed suit, and that's a procedure that the police are no longer allowed to do. What you have here is another procedure that the police have come up with that they used in this case and in other cases, where they have probable cause to believe a particular person committed a particular offense, but they get the person to come down to the police station. They tell them that they're not in custody. They tell them that they're free to leave, and then they...
Okay, well, Counselor, are you suggesting that anytime the police have probable cause that the only thing they can do is put somebody in custody and Mirandize them?
I'm suggesting that when the police are conducting an interrogation in the police station and they have probable cause to believe the person committed the offense and they intend to arrest that person, that they should be required to give that person their Miranda rights.
So you discredit, I guess, the detective's testimony, I think it was at the suppression hearing, that in his mind, yes, Mr. Dock was a suspect, but if he had provided some sort of information that undercut Mr. Ross's pointing the finger at him, that might have eliminated him as a suspect.
Your Honor, what I would really credit is the trial court's comments, because during the motion to suppress, the trial court really hit the nail on the head, because the court said to the detective, it sounds like this is just a way you've come up to get them down there to ask them questions without giving them Miranda rights. And so I understand the officer took the position that, well, I didn't think I had probable cause and I had not made a decision.
But you can still have probable cause, can't you, and conduct a non-custodial interrogation?
I believe that the circumstances here would, the answer to that would be no, because the circumstances here would indicate that it's simply a way to evade Miranda. So I mean, your question, Your Honor, is exactly what they did. They're saying we want to interrogate this man and not give him Miranda rights because we feel like we have a better chance of getting incriminating statements if we don't give him his Miranda rights.
Did Seibert have any discussion in it concerning it being a practice of that particular department, as opposed to in this case where we don't have any evidence of any particular practice or routine with regard to this?
Your Honor, I frankly can't remember whether or not that was an issue in Seibert.
Well, it would be very difficult to indicate that this is a routine by calling somebody in East Texas and asking them to travel to Fort Worth voluntarily. He didn't have to come to Fort Worth with his mother, did he?
No, but that was part of the officer's plan to get him here to interrogate him without giving him Miranda rights. No, he could have said no.
Okay.
That's correct.
And he could have walked out.
And he could have walked out.
Okay, so what is it that is the indicia of circumvention in this case, other than you're just characterizing how this went down as circumvention?
Your Honor, the circumvention is that the officer clearly has sufficient information to take Doc into custody. He has sufficient information to do that.
But that imposes a rule that any probable cause turns any non-custodial interview into a circumvention interview under your premise.
Your Honor, and I don't disagree that that's the premise I'm arguing for, but I think it's a little more than just that. It also includes the interview taking place in an interview room in the police station. It follows the exact pattern that a custodial interview follows. Everything about it is the same thing that the officers do on a custodial interview, except giving the Miranda rights.
Let me ask you, I noticed that in your briefing there were several references to the fact that this was a windowless interrogation room, but I don't recall seeing anything in the record that described whether that room had a window or not. Is there something in the record that
there's a
has
video,
that?
There's a video.
But that's just part of the room, though, isn't
it? Well, I think the video, and I haven't looked at it in a while, I think the video reflects the room, that there's no window in the room. I think that's where we got that from. But the point is that I'm making under this ground is that, just like the trial judge noted in his comments, this appears to be, and in fact is, simply a way to conduct what is, by all other indicia, a typical interview, a custodial interview, without giving the man his Miranda rights. And just like the Missouri versus Siebert situation, just like the Supreme Court recognized there, you can have something that may appear to be a legal process. If you look at it just on its face, it may be a legal process. So in the Missouri versus Siebert place, maybe the officer had the right to talk to somebody without giving them their Miranda rights. But in the context of what he did, it turned something that maybe you could justify under some circumstances into something designed strictly to get around Miranda.
Well, maybe I'm not understanding the distinction here, but in looking at Shiflett and Douthat and all the cases that tell us the four general circumstances that define what custody is, that fourth one is that there's probable cause to arrest, but the police do not tell the suspect that he's free to leave. And here we have probable cause, but they do tell him he's free to leave. So under Douthat, is that not custody?
Well, Judge, that goes to the second ground, and it's a different argument on the first ground that we've raised. And so setting aside the second ground and focusing on the first ground, it those cases and those rules about when you're in custody aren't really pertinent on the first ground, because the whole point of the first ground is the police are not formally taking him into custody in order to circumvent Miranda. And you know, obviously, they intend, I mean, the point of this is that obviously the police intend to arrest Doc. You know, whether they're going to do it today or they're going to do it tomorrow or they're going to do it in a week, they intend to arrest him. They have designed this procedure strictly as a way to interrogate him without giving him his Miranda rights. And so it's just, what we're really arguing for is for the court to take Siebert and the Court of Criminal Appeals adoption of Siebert, and in particular I think it's Justice Kennedy's opinion in Siebert, to take that and to apply it to this situation. The theory being is when the police engage in conduct that has a purpose of evading the application of Miranda, then that is improper and should result in the suppression of the statement.
Was that subjective? I mean, it, it, you're presuming that their purpose was to evade Miranda, but I'm having a hard time coming up. You know, if I were going to put the bumper sticker principle, if we adopt your position here, I mean, what would be the holding? We find that the police can't do what exactly?
Well, Your Honor, if I can lay my hands on it, I think the bumper sticker is what the trial court said. You know, what the trial court said was where he said, and I have this, I quoted this on page 15 of our brief, and he said to, I don't know whether he was addressing it to the detective or to the prosecutor, but he just said, basically, what you're doing is evading Miranda. And so I think
But he ended up not granting the motion to suppress either.
Because he concluded that they could legally evade Miranda. He didn't conclude that they weren't evading Miranda. I think the judge concluded that they could legally do that. And so that's what.
So how have the courts made that distinction?
I'm sorry.
How have the courts made that distinction? That gets me back to my, what is the indicia of circumvention? Does there have to be a practice? Does there have to be evidence that this is a practice in this particular police department? Or can we have indicia of circumvention solely based upon the facts of this one interrogation?
I think the one interrogation is sufficient. I don't see why you would have to have a pattern of, just like you don't have to have a pattern of violation of the Fourth Amendment in order to find a violation of the Fourth Amendment in one particular case. So I don't think there needs to be a record here showing that this is a police department policy. What there has to be is a record showing in this case the police engaged in this conduct whose purpose was to evade Miranda. And the trial court seemed to believe that was the purpose based upon what he heard in the testimony.
How are we going to apply this probable cause rule you advocate? Is the state going to have to disprove that it had probable cause before it conducted a non-custodial interview? I mean, or didn't Mirandize someone?
Ordinarily, the criminal defendant is arguing there isn't probable cause. Now, in a motion to suppress, they'll be arguing, oh, yes, there was probable cause, suppress all the evidence.
I don't think it's necessary for this court to place the burden one way or another to determine whether or not there's probable cause. I think it just calls for the court, and I guess in the initial instance, probably the trial court, but now this court, to look at the objective facts and say, is there probable cause? I don't think it's a question of who has the burden to prove or disprove probable cause. I frankly haven't thought about that, but I just don't see why that would be necessary to put that burden on one side or the other. If I could turn briefly to what I believe is another important issue here, and this is our issue 3, where 38.21 of the Code of Criminal Procedure says that a statement of an accused may be used in evidence against him if it appears that the same was freely and voluntarily made without compulsion or persuasion. And what we're arguing here is that when the police engage in interrogation techniques, and here they were engaged in the Reed technique, which is a well-established police technique that's used to induce people to confess.
Was that discussed before the trial court, or is that solely in your briefing?
That's really solely in our brief as far as identification of what they were doing, calling it the Reed technique. Nobody talked about that.
Has any court ever invalidated a confession because the Reed technique was used?
I'm not aware of a court invalidating a confession. But Texas has a different rule, a more specific, more robust rule in this regard, because in Texas, the code says that a confession must not be the result of persuasion. And persuasion is a word that has a typical common meaning. Now, I understand, and we cited some of these cases as well as the state, that nobody, no court's really gone where we are suggesting that you should go. I understand that.
Well, so basically, what you're, I mean, we know it's well established that the police can't beat a confession out of you, so now you want us to say that if they ask really nicely and give you coffee and bathroom breaks and persuade you, that that's no good either?
What we're asking you to look at is if the police engage in psychological techniques designed to convince somebody to confess, that that is persuasion. And that is what was done here. And although the courts have not gone this far, the facts would support the court going there here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Muskunis, arguing for the state of Texas. May it please the court, counsel. The major problem with appellant's first point of error is that it is, under Texas law, it is completely unsupported. If you'll let me explain, the Carter holding specifically said that in Texas, Siebert will apply only to a deliberate two-step interview process. Appellant didn't object at trial that a two-step interview process was used. He doesn't argue in his brief that a two-step interview process was used. More importantly, the record has absolutely no evidence showing that a two-step interview process was used. Now, the classic two-step interview has three readily identifiable parts. There's a statement taken in violation of Miranda, which requires custody, then a Miranda warning, and then the statement is retaken post-Miranda. None of these things appear in the record. None of these things were alleged at trial. None of these things were alleged on appeal. Without the two-step interview, per Carter, Siebert, and by extension, its progeny, are inapplicable. And because he relies so heavily on Siebert, his argument goes unsupported. Are there any questions regarding point of error one?
Okay. Well, same question I had to him. What were the factual circumstances of Siebert? Were we dealing with a pattern of practice within that particular police department with regard to all of their interrogation? Was that a part of the record? That they had a habit of taking people into custody, actual custodial detention?
Your Honor, I do not know the answer to that question. The state's point is that the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals said that Siebert is to be very narrowly applied in Texas, and it only applies to a deliberate two-step interview. Now, appellant, he seizes on the first prong, deliberate, and I think there's 20 times at least he mentions that word in some form in his brief, but what he doesn't do is address the second prong, two-step interview. And for that reason, his entire point of error should be disregarded.
So what are the limits to police trickery? That's a harsh word, but I mean, are there limits to what police can do in terms of inviting someone to come in? We just want to talk to you about something. Your name came up. Is there a point at which it crosses the line?
There would be a point at which it becomes custodial. And
should that be our only concern, because custodial interrogation triggers Miranda? Is that the bottom line?
In this case, yes. I do believe so. And that kind of leads into the point of error two, where appellant is essentially arguing, well, they had probable cause, so they had to Mirandize him. And that's not the law in Texas. The law in Texas is, and by the way, I don't think that they did have probable cause, because what they had was a tip from a known informant. And what that does is establish reasonable suspicion to investigate, which is exactly what they were doing. Now, probable cause communicated to the suspect during an interview will establish custody. But standing on its own, probable cause does not establish custody. Now, appellant did not and does not identify any point before or during the interview that the police communicated that they had probable cause to arrest the appellant. And even if at some point during the interview...
In other words, you'd have to take some type of statement like, well, we've got on you now, we can arrest you. Something of that nature?
I don't believe so.
Or does it only take a statement along the lines of, well, we know you were there, we know you were participating, we don't know exactly what you did, but you were participating in a particular crime?
I think that it would take the same sorts of facts that you could give to a magistrate and have the magistrate issue an arrest warrant. I could not walk up to a magistrate and say, I want to go arrest that guy for murder because I know what he did, or I know he was there. You'd never get the warrant. And it's the same thing here. And the reason I wouldn't get the warrant is because...
But there were lesser crimes potentially involved. What is the probable cause need to be with regard to that? They've got him, for example, they could argue, and in fact that's what they're doing, is arguing you have probable cause to know he participated in a crime as an accomplice, at the very least, with regard to that ended up in a death. Does the fact that you don't have probable cause to arrest him for murder, does that negate probable cause for some other type of arrest?
No, of course not, and I may have misstated that. But in this case, we don't have that, and that's what the state is arguing. They never communicated probable cause to him. Now, they may say, we know what happened or we know what you did, but that's just dangling a line into a pond hoping for a bite. That's not a communication of probable cause. And I would maintain that it would take the type of communication that it would take to get an arrest warrant. Are there any other questions on that issue? Now, as far as point of error 3 goes, appellant's complaining that his statement was inadmissible because he was persuaded to make it in violation of 3821. I would point out that 3821 appears nowhere in the record. Appellant didn't allege a violation of 3821 in his written motion to suppress. He did not allege the violation of 3821 during the suppression hearing. He provides no authority supporting that the interview rendered his statement involuntary. He hasn't shown that the interview rendered him incapable of making an independent, informed decision to provide a statement. He hasn't shown that his free will was overborne during the interview. And as Justice Kerr said, paraphrasing, under appellant's approach, the statement would be deemed involuntary if the police asked, pretty please tell us what happened. I'm sorry, but that's asinine. And regarding the Reed method, as was pointed out, there is no mention of the Reed method in the record. There's no mention of the police using the Reed method. There's no description of the Reed method, no discussion of the components, no discussion of whether the police employed it. There's no reference to it whatsoever. And the reason I would mention that is because recently the Houston court kicked out this exact same argument as unpreserved. And it's an unpublished decision, DeBlanc v. State, 2018 Westlaw 818351. They just said, look, it's not in the record, it's not preserved. And I mentioned that it's unpublished because they didn't even think the issue was worthy of publication. Are there any questions as to point of error 3? Point of error 4, again, went unpreserved. He didn't object. The argument is that his consent to search the phone was involuntary. He didn't object that his consent was involuntary. He didn't argue it at the suppression hearing. He mentions the Fourth Amendment in his written motion, but the Court of Criminal Appeals has ruled that a defendant does not preserve a constitutional issue where it is not raised at the hearing despite a written motion that raises the constitutional complaint. The state has a signed consent form. They have a tape of the signing. There's nothing on the tape that indicates in the slightest that consent was involuntary. The state created a prima facie case of consent that appellant failed to rebut. Are there any questions why point of error 4 fails? And as far as point of error 5 goes, there is no error to accumulate. Everything, every other point of error fails on its merits, and every other point of error was not preserved. And if there's any question about custody is central to point of error 1, by the way. because without custody, you can't have the two-step interview. Without the two-step interview, none of appellant's cited authority applies. And if there's any question on whether the trial court made the right decision, you just watch the tape and look at the facts and ask yourself, would a reasonable person who is innocent feel that they were under arrest in this circumstance? And the answer is a clear and resounding no. And if there are no other questions, with the court's permission, I will take my seat.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Your Honor, I really just want to make a comment about the probable cause question, because what the state is asking you to hold is that the following facts are not probable cause. A car associated with a co-defendant is seen leaving the scene of a murder. The co-defendant admits to being involved in the murder and implicates Doc as being one of his co-actors. The co-defendant's brother implicates both his brother and Doc as being involved in it. And the state is asking you to hold that those facts do not establish probable cause to get an arrest warrant against somebody. So I certainly disagree about whether that establishes probable cause, but I'm not sure the state really is wanting the court to hold those facts don't establish probable cause, because I'm sure there are going to be cases coming forward, and there have been cases in the past where much less than that establishes probable cause, where it's been litigated.
Would it be necessary to our holding in this case either way to talk about whether there's probable cause or not if we decide that it wasn't a custodial interrogation? Doesn't matter if there was probable cause or not, really, does it?
It does, because on issue one, whether or not it's custodial is not the dispositive question on issue one.
Right, but issue one doesn't turn on whether there's probable cause or not either, just whether they're trying to circumvent Miranda, which is a separate issue, isn't it?
And their circumvention of Miranda is dependent upon there having been probable cause.
Yet they don't have to arrest somebody because they have probable cause.
Well, but if they are ignoring and manipulating the probable cause in order to circumvent Miranda, then it's a different analysis. So in response to your question, I do think the court is going to have to address whether there's probable cause. I think the state thinks that also, because they've spent a lot of time arguing that there's no probable cause.
Let me ask you this. Do you agree with his description of the breadth of the Carter holding?
We're not arguing that Siebert and the cases following Siebert are what control here. We don't have those facts. That's not what this is about. Where we're arguing the Siebert and Carter and those cases come into play, it's for the principle involved. That it's improper to circumvent Miranda. And so, if the state believes we're trying to argue we have the Siebert situation, they've misunderstood our argument. That's not our argument. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, gentlemen, your case is submitted. I thank you for the oral argument. It's been very enlightening, and I appreciate your time coming down here this afternoon.